I recently I went to a used bookstore and they had a copy of Communion, and it was so I've been kind of like just opening it at random, reading a couple bits here and there. And I did notice, and I'd forgotten this, that there's some transcripts of supposed hypnosis sessions with Bud Hopkins, right? Now, is the idea that those are all actual sessions, and are there recordings available, or what?
Yeah, there are recordings available, and I have them, in fact, because they're available at his website for subscribers. Yeah, they're very interesting listening. I mean, they're very disturbing listening. We'll get more into this as we proceed with the piece, because he also looks into other areas of his past that are kind of obscure, that don't seem to have directly to do with aliens and relate to his time in Europe, and seem to have something to do with human interference, and that recording, I also have, that's very disturbing. Plus the first one he did, the first hypnosis session he did, in which he's screaming, and his blood curdling audio footage to hear. And in fact, some of that stuff is on the, is on these audios, because I've incorporated it into the music mashups that I've been doing.
Yeah, where he says he needs a drink.
For example, yeah, can we help you stop screaming? That's one. A feeling of being under absolute control. If you listen to the mashups, you can tell which ones are from the hypnosis sessions, because they're much poorer quality recordings. Sure.
Speaking of, are you guys distracted by the chaos in the pool party sort of next door?
No, not really. It's sort of ambience.
Okay.
Yeah, Sound of Happy Children is kind of ironic backdrop.
Yeah.
So, do you want to continue that thread, do you think? Or?
Would you like to?
I don't know.
Okay, well, I have another question about that. Now, are there, I assume, because Hopkins did a lot of hypnosis sessions, which just seems to be a common sort of strategy among a lot of these investigators, even a guy like John Keel, who was dubious of a lot of claims, he supposedly could hypnotize people and did that too. So it's not just true believers who did that. So it's a fairly common thing. So I assume there's probably a lot of tapes out there of other sessions. Have you heard any other sessions from other people other than Strieber?
No.
I'd be interested to hear some of those, especially one where, let's say, a hypnosis session with somebody where the story became very suspect, like, for instance, the critique of Bud Hopkins, that main case there.
Yeah, Linda Napolitano. Yeah.
I'd like to hear one where it's kind of revealed that the person was obviously a faker and a liar, and hear that side by side with, say, a Strieber or Strieber style tape where, you know, is that a fakeable thing? Is that a realistic thing or what? You know, I mean.
Well, I think if the question of faking and lying, it becomes very muddy when you're talking about under hypnosis, because I think the indication is that they're not faking, they're not consciously faking, and they're definitely not lying. They're allowing themselves to be led by that sort of innate desire to please and to give the sort of paternal, the authoritative figure of the hypnotist what they intuit he or she wants.
Yeah. I mean, to me, just the very idea of hypnosis, if it's actually works, is just, it's like, I mean, that's almost the biggest mystery of all to me. What the hell is it? What's going on, you know?
Yeah, I agree. I've never really been able to get my head around hypnosis, and I've had my experience of going to a hypnotherapist and being in a relaxed state as a result, but I never felt that I was in a different state of consciousness.
Yeah, I don't know much about hypnosis, but or at least its viability, but I think it's certainly possible, but I think it would have to be done very carefully so as not to lead, you know, the person in certain directions.
Yeah.
Try to be scientific about it.
Well, there's this thing called clean language, which I was looking into recently and was even offering these free sort of sessions to people at the website, which is based on this guy David Grove came up with it. It's actually Dave O'Shaughnessy who told me about it. And it's based on this premise that we are unbelievably susceptible to being led by suggestion. Yeah. And it doesn't have to be done consciously or deliberately. Like, it doesn't require an unethical hypnotist or somebody with a very with a conscious specific agenda. We just naturally do it when we interact with people. We unconsciously lead the conversation where we want it to go. Mm-hmm. So the idea of clean language is to reduce that to the absolute minimum, and it's approach is simply to reduce the number of questions that the therapist or the person leading the dialogue can ask. And there are just four or five questions, and they're exactly phrased in exactly way, and you're not supposed to vary them in any way at all. So there's things like anything else. And what is that like? And you can repeat the word that the person said, but even there, you're not supposed to change the form of the word. So if somebody says, you know, I feel terrified, you don't say, what is that terror like? You say, and what is that terrified like? You're not supposed to vary anything that the person says. And a big part of it was is repeating back to the person so that they have it validated what they've said and they feel like they're being heard. But also it is reinforcing their own point of view constantly throughout the process.
I was thinking about this just yesterday, about how like in a psychoanalytic environment, that information that's volunteered, it's not a response to a question, is actually, you know, the most revealing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, you notice, I can't think of an example now, but I think it's in sort of detective shows and whatnot, when the investigating detective thinks that he's looking for evidence of something, he will often, or she, it's usually he, will do the opposite of leading, will actually try and lead the witness in the opposite direction to make sure, and say, oh, so that guy had blue eyes, right? And they go, no, it was brown. In actual fact, he's looking for a guy with brown eyes. He wants to make sure that the witness isn't just giving him what he wants, so he will actually set it up in that the person actually has to assert their point of view. So that would be, that would be more extreme than the clean language, but it certainly is a way to really test if somebody has seen or perceived or experienced something. If they get the sense that you're looking for the opposite of that and they still insist on their experience, then there's a good chance it's real at that point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So with Strieber, I mean, specifically, it's interesting how Bud Hopkins came into picture, because he did right away. And this is in the Prisoner of Infinity later on, but Strieber experienced, when he first spoke to Bud Hopkins, he was on the point of suicidal despair, as he described it. He was ready to throw himself out the window because of this unbearable tension of thinking that what had happened to him, although it felt totally real, wasn't, and therefore he was going completely insane. And so when he spoke to Bud Hopkins, and Bud Hopkins, like, the first thing he said was something like, you're not alone, or there's other people who've had this experience, Strieber said that his tears of gratitude came to him, and he finally had something to cling to. This is real. So that was the initial, as he described it, that was the initial kind of role that Bud Hopkins played for Strieber, was that validating his experience and relieving the unbearable tension of, you know, is this real or am I insane? And from there, although Strieber says that he didn't want to go to a hypnotist who had experience with abductees because he wanted somebody who was neutral, nonetheless, it was Hopkins who recommended the hypnotherapist that Strieber went to. So it seems like he wasn't quite rigorous enough or quite cautious enough, I would say, in terms of really making sure that he was not being pulled into some sort of previously arranged narrative, you know, thing that was looking for people to recruit, so to speak. I didn't put that very well, but I think you guys know what I mean by that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, we don't know with Hopkins, you know, was he just naive and gullible, or was he an asset, or is there a difference, you know, at a certain point, witting or unwitting?
He's certainly highly suspect.
Yeah.
I mean, beyond suspect, I think, in my mind.
Yeah.
Speaking of suspect, in one of the pages that I read, well, actually a couple times it comes up in Communion, I believe, you know, just opening at random, I can't really give the actual reference, but there's a couple places at least where he says, flying saucers, I thought that whole mystery had been completely solved by science already, and I just totally dismissed it. And another part he says something like, flying saucers, how ridiculous, or something like that, you know, the whole alien thing. And that's one thing I absolutely do not, cannot, will not ever buy from a guy who's written, like, before any of these experiences, had written vampire and werewolf novels, any horror, fantasy type fiction, anything like that, to have such a dismissive, materialistic, completely, oh, I thought science had completely solved that, and I had absolutely no question left in my mind that flying saucers were completely, you know, explained away as misperceptions of natural phenomena, and mass hypnosis and marsh gas and so on and so forth and things like that.
Absolutely.
I didn't expect that. It seemed to me like he was setting himself up as, I didn't even think about UFOs. It wasn't even my mind at all. Science had completely resolved it. Now, I can understand that could be a cover, you know, that, you know, because of these experiences that he's had throughout his life, that perhaps he had to, in order to defend himself from complete ego dissolution, he had to completely dismiss the idea of flying saucers because, you know, blah, 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 blah. But, and, you know, if he doesn't go out later and say, you know, I was, you know, in a state of denial or something when he said that, if he seriously presents himself as being completely dismissive of UFOs before this, then I don't accept that.
No, well, you're right not to, because it's actually... It does contradict what he says later, and he never addresses that contradiction, because later he writes about how he was shown a photograph of the face on Mars in 1984. That's a year before. Well, actually, he varies on the date, but it was definitely right before the communion experience, and he even posits that it was the trigger for the communion experience. But he was shown that photograph because he was part of the Mars Anomaly Research Society, some group that he was helping to finance, he was donating to, who were specifically interested in these supposed extraterrestrial artifacts on Mars. So, and that's just one thing. I mean, there are other contradictions, like the story Payne that he wrote, was writing when he started to remember the experiences of communion, is about UFOs, it's about aliens, and that is apparently in the period that he also claims that he dismissed the whole thing and was even scornful of it. So.
The most powerful of these events took place in the months before I had the experience that led to my writing of Communion. On a clear September day in 1985, I found myself at the Manhattan apartment of a scientist friend, John Glidman, looking at the single most incredible thing I had ever seen. It was a photograph of a face, haunting, eerily reminiscent of ancient Egypt. It stared up at me from a desert plain, and, incredibly, from memory. Is this the Gobi? I asked Dr. Glidman. Not the Gobi, he replied. I regarded the image. It reminded me a little of the Sphinx, but there was something harder, more brutal, more primitive about this face. How old? I asked. I was beginning to have a very eerie feeling, as if I could place the thing somewhere in my own past. Possibly 50,000 years, possibly a lot older. I inventoried my mind. Had I seen this in an old book of Egyptian sculpture in a dream? I couldn't get it to return, not quite. I noticed a mischievous smile on John's face. It's a NASA photo. The face is on Mars. Glidman explained that the images had been returned by the Viking orbiter in 1976. I just couldn't believe it, but it was there. The worst part of it, the part that was really shaking me up, was that I remembered it. I damn well remembered it.
Spitting out the demons.
What was I to think? That I'd been to Mars or somehow seen what was on its surface? No matter how I explained it away, seeing the face was still an enormous event in my life, far larger than I could ever have imagined, even until recently, understood. It may well have been the trigger that caused the close encounter of December the 26th, 1985 to take place.
Well, this is a crucial fiction for him because he needs to, in order to be believable, it's crucial that he present himself as sort of an everyman, sort of mundane person, regular Joe.
Who writes novels about vampires and so on and so forth.
Yeah, well, I suppose there is that. Relationship. I mean, they're often like people who are seemingly square and ordinary and conventional do have this very out there fantasy life, and so, and in most people's minds, that isn't a contradiction. Like, you can be very conventional and ordinary while, as a writer, you explore all those realms through the fiction. But in Streber's case, and maybe every case. But certainly in Streber's case, that clearly is not, that's not an accurate picture. I mean, he was in London in the 60s, hanging out with some of the leading personalities of that time, like Eric Clapton and God knows who, and that whole part of his history has been completely buried. Like, he was involved with the Process Church, he was a filmmaker, he was supposedly an underground filmmaker in the 60s in London, at the heart of, that, the countercultural movement. And it's almost impossible to imagine Streber, as we know him today, being part of that scene, right? I mean, he so much emanates the square vibe.
Yeah, he's definitely worked hard to create that impression.
Yeah. I mean, whether I don't want to suggest or assume that it is a that there's some sort of subterfuge there or deliberate manipulation and perception going on. It may well be, as Phil was saying, that it's his own kind of the conflict within himself that he's had to assert this very down home kind of conventional family man value guy in order to keep down, to suppress all of that other stuff.
But if the principal motivator is that the, to be believed,
yeah,
and then everything sort of is structured around that as the centerpiece,
yeah,
then you can see how things could be sort of twisted a bit, you know, and embellished,
yeah,
the opposite of that, whatever that is, downplayed.
Yeah, yeah. Because if, I mean, if he had a public history of being a 60s swinger in London, hanging out with the Process Church and Eric Clapton, and dropping acid and chasing after UFOs as all those guys were doing back then, that would definitely, yes, call into question these experiences, or at least put them in a very different context.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you'd have a lot to cover for there. Now, one of the things also that I picked up from the book, you know, when I got it, was that I'd forgotten the cover where the title says Communion, and I'm talking about the mass market paperback edition that came out, as I think I've talked about before, when I was working at a bookstore locally, and we'd get tons of these in, like every few days we'd sell out, and then we'd have to continually get more in, set up a new display. But it's Communion. And then in type, in a font almost half the size of the title, A True Story, mm-hmm, you know? Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, I read that to make it sound like bullshit, but it's like, that's the first thing that hit me. It's like, A True Story. And right then, you know, I mean, to present it as a true story, there are a lot of different things you got to do to, you know, kind of sell that idea. Like, for instance, oh, I'd completely dismissed UFOs and just figured science had completely solved that sort of enigma, and so on and so forth. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, that just right there on the cover, before I even cracked it, I was already a little suspicious. Not suspicious so much as very skeptical about everything that I read. Now, maybe that filtered it, and then I wasn't, you know, reading honestly at the first time I read it, but, you know, it still today affects me to have that on the cover there, you know?
Hmm. So is it a question of, like, the Streba does protest too much, or
a bit, but you know, these are just things that you would necessarily have to do if you want to sell this as a true story. Now, he might say, oh, that wasn't my idea, that the publisher put that on there, but it's so large that it's basically a subtitle. There's no communion colon a true story, but it says Communion, a true story. Now, when you open it up, it says the same thing on the front page, Communion, a true story. So he must have, I would think, had written that as a subtitle.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that means a lot of things. A true story. It's like, well, stories, you know, even if they're history books can't be believed 100%. As we know, it's all a story. You put things together and, you know, you present the same historical fact one way or another and tell a completely different story and lead to a completely different conclusion. Mm-hmm. Depending on how you present it, what you leave out, what you put in, and so on, and, you know, how you present it, everything like that. So, I mean, to me, at least, you know, my initial impression, what I feel when I read this and some of the first associations that pop into my head are, I think I've mentioned before, Truman Capote and In Cold Blood, where he, I mean, even though there were other examples before that, I believe, but I can't remember what they are. But his idea when he wrote that book was he was pioneering a new style of nonfiction novel. And then the other thing, the other association that pops in my head is Hunter S. Thompson and Gonzo journalism, where he would make himself the center of the story and then fabricate events. Not everything actually happened. There's a kernel of actually what happened. And then at a certain point, he would get down to the facts and give you the actual supposed true story of what happened. But around that, there's a lot of fabrication. a lot of misrepresentation, a lot of fictionalization, and so on and so forth like that. Mm-hmm. And it does not surprise me at all, now that you mentioned Strieber and his 60s associations there, that a guy like that, who basically was part of that whole generation, would have those as like ideas and concepts from an artistic, stylistic sort of viewpoint, kind of cooking in his head and trying to come up with, you know, a new type of novel, quote unquote. Not that it's, you know, I mean, you can write a novel based on your life, basically. All autobiographies can be seen as novels in a way. So, you know, there might be a lot of true facts in there, and then, you know, but I'm not saying I, you know, complete dismissal. Otherwise, why even talk about it, you know?
No, right. No, it's definitely not. Well, I feel certain that it's not as simple as that. And he himself came in those right after it came out, like, asked that question rhetorically, is this a new kind of novel that I'm willing to even do book tours saying it's real? No. Like, he was aware that that possibility existed in people's minds, and not to suggest that he couldn't be clever enough to anticipate that and make that all part of the bullshit, but my sense with Strieber is it absolutely isn't that, that it's a deeper layer of a something very similar, which is this crucial fiction, this idea that for Strieber, because for him there were only two alternatives once whatever this was happened. Either it was real, absolutely a true story, or he was insane and there was no in-between gray area, then actually presenting it as nonfiction to the world and convincing the world that it was a true story was his way to convince himself that he was not insane. So then it's far more complex what's going on, and Strieber would be fully invested not just in making others believe it, but in believing it himself. And maybe he would even suppress, you know, his elements of his past and elements of the story in order to maintain that fiction.
Yeah, I was just going to say that sort of a fundamental psychological concept, you know, the idea that if you have difficulty believing something, then you reach out and you try to convince others, and if that works, then you can sort of use that as sort of fodder, or, you know, you can feed your own disbelief through the process of convincing someone else.
Feed your disbelief, or
I guess I said that backwards, but the disbelief is there, and you can feed it. The belief that is coming from the outside.
Yeah,
you know, if he is absolutely sincere and all that, then, you know, he'd have to be, well, I don't know, I'm not sure what the point I was going to make, but yeah, he'd have to be a really fucked up guy to really have all these ulterior motives and knew from the start what he was going to try to do, and pulling one over on everybody. He'd be, you know, he would be really, no, I'm not denying he's not really fucked up. He could be really fucked up in that way too, or instead of in all the other ways. But yeah, I mean, I'm willing to give him the benefit of the doubt for not being that totally, I don't know what the word would be, not nefarious, but, you know,
right,
that much of a plan, ulterior motive behind it all. Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And which, you know, hats off to him then, if he can manage that. And he's gotten people to accept it and believe it, and, you know, started this whole community of people discussing all these experiences and so on and ideas. Well, you know, again, hats off to him. I mean, even if it's a lie, it's like, it's a fantastic lie, and I give him, you know, credit just for that alone.
I think that's rarely the case, though, Phil, I would say. I mean, I just think I think that's less likely than...
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well, that's what I'm saying. It's like, even with that possibility, if you want to completely dismiss it that way, it's like, it's still a huge achievement. So, you know, it's like it doesn't, that doesn't give me an out to just reject it all. You know, it's like, wow, how did he do this then? Let's study him, because, you know, I could take over the world if I had that power.
Well, he would have had help. I mean, either right. way, I think he had help, assistance from, you know, invisible, visible, human, non-human, whatever, is behind Strieber. It was an essential part of his establishing himself as a, as a spokesperson, establishing his ministry of information there. So hence, part of this exploration is looking into the past and looking at how did he become the person he is today, and what forces, both inner and outer, were at play, were instrumental in that, you know, the rise of Strieber. So, I'm on... thing that is coming to mind when talking about this whole fiction non-fiction thing is that on the first edition of The Hunger, it describes Strieber the author as having worked in diverse fields as diverse as underground filmmaking, where he made a documentary on the Process Church, and this is pretty much the only documentation of this fact, although we have managed to confirm it, I believe. Oh yeah, Strieber himself admitted or spoke about it with Peter Levend on one of the Dreamland shows, so we've confirmed that one, that he made a documentary about the Process Church. The other one is on the first edition of The Hunger, is that he worked with intelligence. And Strieber has since disclaimed that, like there's a disclaimer from the editor, I forget. I mean, this is, we managed to hunt down a copy of the first edition of The Hunger and get a, you know, a scan of that book flap, so it's definitely, it definitely was on that first edition of the book. Strieber's disclaimer is harder to confirm, but it's on the internet, like that text from the bio is on the internet, but then there's a disclaimer from the publisher or something, I don't know what it is, but Strieber said that he regretted that his editors embellished his past that way, specifically about the intelligence work. So, okay, well, he's laid it at the door of the editors, and that is possible, but even so, I mean, the context of Strieber's whole, the larger story, it seems that it wasn't an innocent embellishment anyway, at the very, very least. I mean, this is, because it's kind of followed him his whole life, like he himself keeps making these slips of the tongue where he says he worked for intelligence, or did he, or didn't he, and he himself doesn't seem to know. Like he said, as far as my work for intelligence, it never happened, as far as I know. And he's always talking about these friends he's got in intelligence, like even, you know, Bruce Lee, this, the, I think it was his agent or editor, I always forget these exact roles, but he was involved with Communion anyway when it was first published, and he witnessed one of the visitors or two of the visitors. On one of the audio, Strieber says, I didn't believe Bruce Lee when he first told me that story because I knew that he worked with intelligence. So these things keep popping up around Strieber, and that may be the first example of it, is when it actually said, in the non-fictional bio on his second successful novel, that he worked with intelligence. So it's like, you know, a true story or not? Like, which is true here? Like, he was somebody was making up stuff about his life, or it's true. But either one is very kind of raises flags to me.
Yeah, Lee was his editor.
Editor, thank you.
At the time of Communion, an editor from William Morrow and Company, Bruce Lee, saw two visitors in a bookstore, in the Madison Avenue bookstore in Manhattan. He saw them paging through the book and saw them, heard them saying that everything in it was all wrong, which doesn't surprise me in the least. If you've spent 5 minutes with the Greys, you know they're always going to do that. If you're right, they're going to say you're wrong. If you're wrong, they're going to love you. So you got to be careful with that. They are very dangerous in that sense. He was stunned by what he was seeing. He found himself face to face with these beings from another world who were wearing hats down over their faces. They had the same huge dark eyes that I had described. They were right, he said, they were right off the cover of the book. So I knew Bruce as an old intelligence hand, and I thought, well, maybe this is not true. I have evidence from my life that there is such a person, another person inside me, mm-hmm. who has a completely different set of memories and different abilities, an entirely different mind.
Right.
You know, especially in a case you're talking to somebody who's actually struggling with this now, and I don't think that I did it. I don't know what I did exactly connected with this in terms of intelligence work. Apparently nothing. I can't remember anything at all, not even a snatch of anything. But I had a friend who recruited for the CIA. We both did this together when we were at the university, and a rather famous man came and had lunch, took me to lunch after I had applied, and said to me, "You do not proceed with this. You will be killed.
Really?
You will not live if you join the CIA." So I told my friend Wilford about this, and he sort of laughed it off, and he joined. He was in it for about 10 years. He retired, and he was killed.
It seems like he sort of wants to have it both ways, at least as far as the intelligence connections go. You know, when it sort of serves his purpose, well, then he's got intelligence connections. But when it draws suspicion, then I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I think that's a... Go ahead.
I was going to say it's a common ego boost sort of story that people will give, you know, especially people who, I'm not saying Strieber would be one of these people, but you know, there are some people who are just in such a, well, maybe not a fantasy world, but they just think they can put anything over on anybody to where they'll just tell people, "Oh yeah, I worked for the FBI for, you know," it's like you can bring up all kind, maybe they did kind of things. It's like, no, not really. Most of these people not. Like, for instance, my wife's mother, after their divorce, she took up with some guy, and he was kind of a shady kind of guy, and he would tell the daughters these stories about how he was, you know, how he worked for the CIA or something like that, or, yeah, that was when I was, you know, working for the FBI, or what, you know, complete lie sort of subterfuge kind of thing, you know, just some guy who drank a lot of beer and thought he could tell people anything he wanted and they'd believe it because they were so gullible and he was so sharp kind of thing, you know,
mm-hmm.
complete ego boost sort of deal, mm-hmm. you know, to impress other people. So there's, you know, even if true, that's, you know, say he did really work for intelligence, Strieber, you know, there's probably a little bit in there that wants to brag about that, you know, I mean, why not? It's like, yeah, I worked for intelligence. No, I didn't. I mean, you know, and then go back and forth and everything. But yeah, I mean, I could see it's like you can't get rid of that ego boost sort of desire to tell everybody, guess what I did, you know, kind of thing. So I can see that going back and forth and then him realizing, well, he can't, you know, but then that just would make him seem like not only very Machiavellian, but very confused. You know what I mean? Not even realizing what he's saying one minute or the next,
mm-hmm.
and then backpedaling constantly. He, you know, that just adds to more layers of, he'd have to be completely fucked up, in which case I don't think he could achieve or do half the things that he's actually done if he was that fucked up. And maybe that people that fucked up could, but I don't know.
Well, that's a question, isn't it? Because if it don't like to put big ifs out there, but if he was being helped and backed and supported and promoted, by unseen agencies, then that would make that more feasible, that no matter how confused and inconsistent he is, that somebody is managing the output in such a way and sort of handling him in such a way that despite all of that, he continues to thrive.
And, you know, especially, and also if he has been, and I guess this is another if, but if he has been, you know, messed with, he may remember certain things at certain times, and at other times be in another state of mind where he's unable to remember certain things.
Yeah. Well, that was the case with the Whitman incident. He remembered being there, but then he became convinced it was a screen memory because he couldn't corroborate his presence there, and he couldn't account for why he would have been there at the Whitman shooting. So then he went back and forth on that one. Like, from in communion, he wasn't there, and by the time of transformation, he was there. And that's a pretty huge event to be unsure about, like witnessing somebody shooting a bunch of students from a tower in Texas.
Yeah. Definitely. That's just not believable that someone would forget that.
Right. Well, he didn't claim to forget it. He claimed to remember it but not believe his own memories, but that is also kind of incredible.
Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah, again, you know, just as with the, you know, what do the other hypnosis tapes with different claimants and different hypnotizers and so on, what do they sound like and how does it compare? I would like to know how his, because there's a lot of people who were there too. So, you know, is there anyone else who has a similar story to tell, or is he the only guy who didn't believe he wasn't there later? You know, I would be more inclined to believe it's like, yeah, that was kind of common sort of thing that occurred with a few people who, you know, weren't really sure later because they didn't, you know, were in a state of denial or whatever, too much shock or trauma.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, I would like to know other cases for to have a comparison.
So, well, it's a couple of thoughts I've had while I've been talking. One was that a reader for this material, chapter 6, even mentioned, they mentioned how they'd had many similar spirit experiences to my own and how they'd never before connected them to kind of UFO or sort of, because they've also had a lot of anomalous experiences or transcendental experiences. And so they were beginning to consider the possibility that I'm putting forward with this piece that, and what you're suggesting, that it could be perfectly mundane, quote unquote, like common, ordinary experiences at a very formative time that generate these fantasies that then somehow assume some kind of reality. And so he pointed out that, you know, he's got this obscure memory of having something shoved up his butt when he went to the doctor's, or must have been the doctor, couldn't have been the dentist, but anyway, and his mother denies it, but now he wonders, well, maybe the guy just stuck a thermometer up my butt, and I mean, I think he was like an infant at the time. And so, yeah, that does beg the question for me, like for an infant, a psyche that's wide open and that has, because of that or related to that, it doesn't have any kind of interpretation system in place for its experiences. It's just experiencing them full body, full psyche experience. How would that experience, if it was traumatic, how traumatic would it be, and how would that trauma then be assimilated into some sort of internal narrative later in life? So, and then the other thing I was thinking was that this does seem to have to do with Whitley being a writer. It's a chicken or an egg. Did he become a writer because these experiences happened, or are these experiences happening to some extent because he chose to be a writer? But I know that from what he said that he wanted to be a writer from like 8 or something. The age of 8, I can't remember the exact age, but it was very young. The first thing he wrote was about the moon, significantly enough. And so I have that in common with Whitley to some extent. I wasn't that young, but I did start writing at about 10 or something. I know I started making audio recordings of my voice when I was like 7 or something, so that's kind of crazy to think about. I started that early. But anyway, bringing it back to what you're discussing, and that's kind of the core of this, the whole controversy, such as there is around Streba, like, you know, how real is this question? Well, I think it's less, isn't it less a question of, you know, how much is he inventing than a question of how much is his capacity to invent actually generating these experiences as real experiences?
There was a, I believe, an anthropologist. I can dig up the actual references. She studied evangelical Christians and specifically wanted to get down to the heart of people who claim to speak with God and hear God, have conversations with God on a daily basis, and are somehow guided by God directly, and the process in which they go through to actually have those experiences, or at least to get to the point to where they can claim that they have those experiences. And their churches were, their instruction to them was, when you get up in the morning, pour yourself a cup of coffee, and then pour a cup of coffee for God, and pretend that that's God's coffee, and talk to God every morning. And just kind of believe that you're talking to God, and believe that that's God's cup of coffee, and he's drinking that coffee with you. And after a period of time, they begin to get advice and messages and hear things that God says based upon that, accepting that as real, sort of entering into that imaginary sort of relationship sort of thing. Sort of like as an adult, pretend you have an imaginary friend. And if you get into that totally enough, perhaps you'll begin to actually see things, hear things, think you hear things, see things, have dreams at least, and so on and so forth. I'm not arguing for anything because I'm uncomfortable when I argue for anything. I just don't know. I'm in the dark about a lot of this stuff. And my intuition is to kind of pull back and kind of squint at it a little bit and look for more information of a certain nature to give me more support. So, you know, if you're not tied down to a strict biblical interpretation of everything, like the evangelicals who are pouring cups of coffee for, God or Jesus or whoever, but you're a horror author who's maybe a lapsed Catholic, so he has a little bit of that somewhere in him, who's had these experiences, or at least has claimed to have these experiences, and who's engaged in all these things imaginatively, and may or may not be up to something, some strange processes at home in order to come up with more of this material, because he's just into that sort of thing, and you're an extravagant inventor. I mean, there's enough there to at least support the continued call for more evidence to support the actual trauma, even if it's just the best guess possible. You know, it's like half fragmented, half remembered memories and dreams blending together from childhood can create all sorts of things to go on.
Yeah. Well, how about this to consider, that in, what are we talking about here, 25 years since communion, but nobody specifically has researched or investigated the Streba case. I mean, Ed Conroy did report on communion, but that just dug around his hometown. Turned out Ed Conroy knew, you know, was friends of the Streba family, so that was fortunate. He knew everyone, but that's also fishy in my mind. And he didn't really dig. He corroborated some of Streba's stories, sure, but he didn't. It predated a lot of this material, and certainly specifically the government program of in childhood, that one hadn't come out yet. But still, since that time anyway, nobody has investigated the Streba case. And as I pointed out in this piece I just sent you, it's like there is no Streba case. that's the weird thing, because he's taken it over. There's Whitley Strieber and unknowncountry.com, but there's no, like, you've got the Betty and Barney Hill case, you've got the Napolitano case, you've got this, you've got that, but there's no Whitley Strieber case. Like, I think it's some kind of a glamour magic. I think Whitley and his handlers, his hypothetical handlers, have cast a spell over the whole thing in some weird way. Something of this magnitude, you don't take one person's word for it, right?
Right.
You just don't. That's not the way that it works. There are things that we can deduce just by looking at the output itself, and there are patterns. So, for example, as in this chapter 6, it pointed out how in Communion he describes these early childhood memories, ordinary quote-unquote memories, nothing to do with secret schools or aliens or anything like that, of technology interfering with genitalia. I mean, specifically, like, he stuck some friction toy, quote-unquote, up a nun's skirt and got her agitated. It sounds like a euphemism to me. and then a friend got his penis stuck in a bicycle pump, which I don't know how that happens. He didn't go into detail.
Yeah. Well, that happened to me yesterday.
What? Yeah. Happens all the time. Happens at least once a week to Keith. Damn it, it happened again.
So, I mean, what do you make of that? Because is Whitley that ingenuous that he puts that material out there and he himself doesn't notice the very striking parallels with erectile probe like 30 years later? Does he really see those memories as completely innocent? And if so, that is remarkable in itself. If not, what's his game here? You know, there's something there that is really very telling, but just what's it telling? I mean, to me, all I can say for sure is there's a pattern there. There's something throughout his life, and what it indicates to me is that there's some primary trauma that has been suppressed that he's not remembering, and it's filtering through in these fiction or non-fictional or these screen memories or these embellishments or whatever they are, but this series of incidents that he's describing often as unrelated that basically have this recurring theme, and there's, you know, that's just one example.
Yeah, you are making a very strong psychological case for the reality of this. And then if you go from the other, from the physical, you know, the outer end, you know, psychological, but the objective, not the subjective, I don't even know, I don't want to use the terms because then people want to argue terms with me. I don't know, but I'm just going to say from the outside. If you go from the outside and then meet in the middle, you know, I mean, yeah. But yeah, as far as the psychological case, you've made it. And obviously there's something there. Now, my own personal experiences, I only think about my own personal experiences mainly. I don't write fiction. You know, everything I have is about the actual experiences, actual dates, actual personalities involved.
You know.
Whereas Strieber is going from an imaginative sort of standpoint, you know? So I never really get to the point of covering them up. Whereas he's filtered everything. Now that could be that the experiences were so traumatic, which is another argument in that case, I think. The experiences were so traumatic that he can't even approach it directly like that. He only has these fragmented memories and everything and dreams and these strange things to report, and then a lot of fiction and then a lot of other strange material he's produced later, which does again suggest something very much more traumatic than what I experienced.
Yes, but there's a flaw in what you've just said there, Phil. I'm sure that Keith spotted it.
Yeah.
Because Whitley himself doesn't see it the way that you're seeing it.
Doesn't see what?
What he's doing. Whitley himself has written, well, I'm not suppressing memories. Which is kind of what you just said, in a way. I'm not embellishing, I'm just reporting the facts. But of course that's what it looks like to you.
Right. Well, I'm not saying in my own personal output, I'm saying that I would be more than happy to discover actual things that account for whatever experiences I've had and have everything debunked and say, okay, all the synchronicities, all the experiences, all the dreams, all those mystical experiences, all those other things, completely debunk them.
Would
sort of
you know?
That.
I mean,
whereas Whitley says if you revealed it all to be a fantasy,
it would break his
heart. It would break his heart.
Well,
it's like, no, you wouldn't. You'd break my heart if you just keep me in the fantasy. I don't want to be in the fantasy any longer.
Well, what do you think of that, Keith?
Be careful what you wish for.
Uh-huh. But mm-hmm. Do you find it convincing?
Not really.
No, I think because we've all got our crucial fictions, so part of yours, Phil, is the crucial fiction that you don't have crucial fictions and that you don't care if your crucial fictions get crucified anyway.
Oh, I have them, but I don't. He says I'm not suppressing anything, which, you know, that's exactly what somebody who is suppressing something would say. I'm not suppressing anything.
Yeah, but somebody who cared if their fantasies were torn apart would say just what you said as well, that they don't care.
Possibly, yeah.
And we all care. I mean, that's the nature of what we're talking about.
Right.
It's our illusion to what we cling to, by definition.
Exactly. Well, that also is ego defending itself from dissolution.
Yeah.
And as far as I know, the only way to really get around that is some sort of return to direct experience. And letting go of all the stories.
Yeah.
You know, I have so many stories of, oh, when I was 9, this happened. Oh, when I was 8, that happened. This, that, and the other. I'm tired of them all.
Well, like, yeah, I think it. Well, I'm with you there, but obviously not tired enough to let go of them completely. Is a thing I would add. But I was going to say that Whitley. I mean, maybe this is central to my interest and why I'm doing this at all. He's magnifying something to these, you know, extreme proportions, so we can see it clearly, but there's something that we're all doing, which is we're spinning this fantasy narrative to sustain the illusion of, well, you know, the illusion that we are what we think we are. And it snowballs. And writing is a way to actually take charge of that process and make it semi-conscious. But maybe because of that, it can take us over, or we can lose control of it all the more so because we have the illusion that we're doing it consciously. I don't know. But it does seem that Whitley is an extreme case, not just because he's a writer, but because he's a writer of fantasy fiction or non-fiction fantasy or whatever you want to call it. But I think it's easy to fall for the temptation to diagnose or to think that an ego fantasy which is fantastic is more of a fantasy than one that's mundane. So, like, your fantasy of being Phil, who's this and who's that, who sits in his basement and watches movies and doesn't care if his fantasies are dismantled, whatever your fantasy is, it's probably no less elaborate than Whitley's. It's just different.
Possibly, but I would say his is probably more elaborate.
Well, he's written more books.
Right. Always had all that output. I've attempted, but I've never really succeeded at doing anything like that. So,
I mean, obviously,
I'm having 5 stories, and that's it.
I'm having a conversation with you and Keith, and I wouldn't be able to have one with Whitley, even if it was about something else. I mean, he does seem to be more deeply ensconced in his narrative, in his story,
right.
more possessed or consumed by his ego. I'll grant you that.
Well, it's a lot of career aspects, of course, apply to that. That, you know, he has this imaginative output, and he has an audience of followers or consumers, at least.
Yeah. So really, there but for the grace of God, go you and I, or would have gone you and I. If, probably too late for us now. But.
Yeah, I wish I could have taken all my experiences and created things from them, or my anything, any experience I've ever had, you know, and created something from it. But I've never been able to create anything from experience other than my own ego, basically.
Well,
that's some product.
Your greatest creation right now.
Yeah, my only creation. Yeah, all my energy has gone into that.
It's a lot.
But as far as products, I would rather have products. I would rather be a shallow, unindividuated, highly successful author than a loser who's maybe a little more self-aware than some people who engage in the fantasy as fantasy and don't want to spoil. Like any writer, it's like, well, I don't want to talk about my process. I don't want to go through analysis because then, you know, it'll diffuse all my creative impulses and I'll stop creating. Like David Lynch, there's several interviews he'll talk about how he had a couple therapy sessions, and or was it the first therapy session he went to? He asked the therapist if, you know, if they really got to the bottom of his issues and problems, would it harm his ability to create? And he said, yeah, probably. And he just walked out.
Right.
So that sort of idea where, you know, if Whitley really was completely honest and sincere about everything, then, you know, he wouldn't be writing and creating and doing what he does. I don't think.
Well, not the same output, certainly.
No, not at all.
And I think that there is an element there that makes it compelling, which relates to this, that he's wrestling with demons, and because that's the cliche of the writer. But I think, yeah, Whitley's he's crossed a line that is very dangerous to cross, which is that he's writing fiction as non-fiction or vice versa. So it may not be clear to him the extent to which he's feeding his demons in order to keep the story alive. Mm. Well, funnily enough, David Shana said this to me recently in a one-to-one. He said that, I think that you're feeding sugar to the yeast of the virus that is making you sick, or the ego, the fantasy narrative that we're talking about here. You're feeding sugar to the yeast so that you can observe it more, so you can write about it, so you can study it. And I think that's true, and I considered it yesterday. Well, and he said, you know, that's fair enough, you know, job well done if that's what you're doing. And I thought about it yesterday, I thought, well, actually, yeah, that's okay. I mean, if it means that I'm suffering much longer and seemingly unnecessarily because of that, but the result is that I really get a clear picture of this that may be useful to others, then that's fair enough. It's not conscious anyway. If I could make a conscious choice, I'll quit writing tomorrow and my ego will dissolve and I'll become an enlightened being, then of course I would make that choice, but I can't anyway, so fuck it, you know. It's a compulsion, and not all compulsions are unhealthy by definition, I don't think.
Earlier I was thinking about how writing is a way to sort of codify or concretize your ideas or your narrative, which I guess could potentially be helpful if, as you were just sort of describing there, you were able to observe that and say, okay, you know, I've codified something here, which really can't be codified.
Codified?
Yeah, like a law, you know, like law codes.
Yeah, right.
You know, it's dangerous to do that. But I think if you were able to then observe that or take a look at it and see it as that, as, you know, that you've concretized something, carved it in stone,
Yes. I'm getting a weird sort of analogy here. I don't know how accurate it is, but of a mad doctor who creates viruses in order to study them, in order to heal people, but then gets so carried away with the power of being able to create these viruses that he ends up just creating more and more diseases and, you know, creating the very opposite thing that he set out to create, which was cures.
And that, like a plot that, for a Whitley Strieber novel. Don't let him hear that. He's going to steal it.
But I think that...
You should write it first.
I think that relates to the metaphor of, you know, because you said he's wrestling with demons. That reminds me of the, what is it, battling monsters or whatever, and to be careful that you don't become the monster that you're fighting.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I know I've experienced that in my own experiences, and I've seen it, you know, in others as well.
Yes, and it's the thing that's coming to my mind anyway is it's the result of taking what one does too seriously.
Yeah, and I had I think it was actually a Catholic priest tell me when I was pretty young, I think about 12 or so, to be careful what I despised, because I would become that.
Advice from a padre?
Yeah. And of course it didn't make any sense to me at the time. I just thought he was crazy. But I remembered it.
It seems like it's more, there's more layers still, or at least one more, because we despise what we won't admit we are like, right? We project it. So in a way, we already are what we despise. Otherwise, we wouldn't feel so strongly about it.
Yep.
Well, you know, there's the shadow, of course. So.
Sure.
No more than that, but yeah, that's the drama of the shadow, yeah. Basically.
Right, so struggling with demons, well, I think Jacob, he wrestled with an angel, right, and then he became Israel the next day. And I mean, maybe it was only an angel because it blessed him. I don't know if that means anything, but it seems like the way we relate to our own unconscious determines the way we experience it, and even in the end, like what it becomes as it becomes conscious, as it manifests in us as, you know, us, that, you know, that is determined by how we relate to it. So, like the thesis with Whitley, I think we're getting fairly close to what it is, that if he has had these formative experiences that have caused this split, and so there's an aspect of his own psyche which is self-tormenting and self-rejecting, and he's not able to or willing to actually see that and integrate that. Instead, he's projecting it outward onto all of these narratives. The more that he does that, and the longer that he keeps that disowning, projecting strategy up, the more that disowned fragment would possess him completely. So he would,
the stronger it would become.
Yeah, he would then become he would end up becoming the thing that he was attempting to overcome, or eradicate, or defeat. It's hard to say what it is in Strieber's narratives, because he himself doesn't seem to be sure. Like, he talks a lot about evil. He read The Master of the Key, that's full of all kinds of dark sort of Catholic imagery.
Mm-hmm.
But where is it? Like, he himself isn't able to identify it clearly in his stories, unless you go back to the early fiction, or actually even the later fiction. So it's there, but I suppose that would be the case, is if you weren't identifying it in yourself and owning it, you would just constantly be creating external versions of it, and that would animate fiction for a horror writer especially.
And it could be a shifting, you know, sort of thing. It wouldn't have to be consistent, just as long as it was externalized.
Right. In fact, you would want it to keep shifting, because otherwise, if it became fixed, you would end up confronting it and seeing that it was a straw man.
Well, the science is perfectly clear. But the truth is, they're so far beyond civilization that they're not even in the same league as we are in that respect. They know absolute morality, and they live by it. This is why they are willing to kick and to cherish. They want to be called the Greys. This is their idea. Because gray, of course, is a mixture of black and white. It's not divided into good guys versus bad guys. We're not dealing with some kind of Buck Rogers stuff here. This is real life. It's real complicated. This is real life. The science is perfectly clear. Are you strong enough? Can you take it? And the more you can take, the more they will dish out. I've lived with that all of my life.
It's a feeling of being under absolute control. How do I know that? Because it is bullshit.
My being and my body, questions and memories, dark memories.
You have absolutely no right. We do have a right. You know, the truth is, I don't know what that is. I don't know whether it's a bug or what.
Planet Claire has pink hair. All the trees are red. No one ever dies there. No one has a head.
My being and my body are questions and memories, dark memories.
Who the hell is that? Is that somebody? Is that somebody?
Some say she's from Mars, or one of the seven stars that shine after 3:30 in the morning. Well, she is it!
I don't think I like that. I like that.
She came from planet Claire. She came from planet Claire.
You have absolutely no right. We do have a right. We do have a right.
She came from planet Claire.
We're not dealing with some kind of
hide your stuff here. This is real life. It's real complicated. This is real life. It's real complicated. This is real life.
The science is perfectly clear.